This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Corporate Service Supply and Manufacturing, a DJI Enterprise dealer providing DJI equipment and support for law enforcement, public safety, construction, and other commercial users of unmanned aerial systems. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/css. And by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/goengineer. You're listening to episode 265 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. And Max, we got snow and ice yesterday. It's November. It was a complete mess here. There were no drones flying anywhere. Cars were littered everywhere. So, it was just a mess. And I didn't get to go to Alan Parsons, which really pissed me off.
But that's rescheduled till what, the spring? So you'll have another chance at it?
Well, March. So the potential for snow is there too. So, but that being said, we got a lot of drone news this week.
Yeah, some good stuff.
And in my quest for the ultimate set of letters, we've got AUVSI TUOG. Aurora Flight Sciences makes a hail. It had to happen about deliveries and food deliveries. DOI OAS requests heavy lift firefighting UAS and feeling a little sheepish in Australia. So what do you think? Should we get started?
Yeah, let's get started, David.
Well, this first story comes from visionsystems.com. New AUVSI Trusted UAS Operator Program. Trusted Operator Professional Certification. AUVSI, I guess, is trying to standardize what it means to be a certified commercial pilot.
And they've created this Trusted Operator Program, or TOP, TOP. And AUVSI says they've worked with industry experts to create this, so they didn't just invent this on their own. And AUVSI says that they created this program, quote, to raise the trust and acceptance of the use of unmanned aircraft around the world. TOP is a professional unmanned systems community initiative aimed at supporting industry-accepted remote pilot standards and protocols, which will result in the safe and sustainable advancement of the industry. And they've got three different certification levels, level one, level two, and level three. And they say the different levels correspond to levels of safety precautions required. So I think this is a great idea to have a certification program here, especially one that's developed by the industry itself.
Agreed. You know, and in a way, the FAA is benefiting. We're setting up a standardization system, you know, where people are going to get their licenses, but the person getting their license from one organization is still going to be equivalent to getting their license at another one. Up till now, we've had schools geared towards Type 107 certification, but not necessarily teaching the same basics.
And this, of course, is something that many, many other industries do, where they create a system, a certification program, or some method for training and certification to ensure the quality of the professionals in their industry. It also helps the consumers, the people buying drone services from others, because they can come to rely on these certifications as indicators of quality of the service they're getting. Now, we mentioned the three different levels. Level one covers relatively low-risk operations, and these are for flights under Part 107 restrictions that don't require a waiver, like flights during the day, below 400 feet and away from people. So that's kind of the easy level. Level two, they say, would be suitable for companies that want to conduct flights near expensive infrastructure, such as power lines, wind turbines, things like that, or any operation that requires or would require an FAA waiver. And then the final level three, that would address flights in, they say, safety critical environments, like near chemical, oil, gas, nuclear, mining facilities, even if they are offshore and no waiver is required. So those are the levels. We'll have some links in the show notes with more details, but AUVSI provides a list of training providers and the certification bodies. And there are four training providers: Consortic, Dart Drones,
Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and Praxis Aerospace Concepts, Inc. It's kind of interesting because my insurance license's education is always through Praxis. But what's really nice about this is, besides the levels, they've thought ahead and gone beyond. It's one thing being certified to fly, but it's also another to be certified to teach somebody else how to fly. And AUVSI has thought ahead and has got training programs to be trainers, which is really good. So I'm very proud of AUVSI because this is a really complete, well-thought-out package. And hopefully it will become at least the start for standardization in our universe. And, you know, we talked about it, Max, consolidation and certification. So we're getting there.
And there are two certification bodies, again, Praxis, which also provides training, and SGS. As far as the Praxis training is concerned, there's a menu they have. And again, we'll have a link in the show notes on the website. But they have this series of training programs, the different levels for remote pilots, for pilot instructors, and for service providers. And they're not inexpensive, especially if you're talking about a level three, you know, one of the higher level trainings for something like a service provider or a training provider. You're talking about multiple thousands of dollars. But that's, I think, fairly typical across different industries, I mean. And presumably the quality of the training from Praxis as well as SGS, you know, warrants that that kind of price point.
So let's move on to some, we're talked about training, let's move on to some hardware. This from aviationweek.com. Aurora builds stratospheric solar aircraft with Boeing's backing.
Aurora Flight Sciences, which is now part of Boeing, has been building high altitude, long endurance HALE drones for quite a while now. And what we're looking at here, though, is the Odysseus, which is huge. This is a big airplane, David.
243-foot wingspan built in three sections. Anybody who knows any sort of mythology knows what Odysseus is, and I hope that this doesn't bode well. This doesn't bode for the aircraft. If you didn't know who Odysseus was, Odysseus and his son Icarus escaped by flying with wings made of wax, and Icarus flew too close to the sun and fell to his death. But big aircraft. We can get 20 degrees latitudes as batteries improve. Latitude will. What they're saying is they got a really, really big wing, and the bigger the wing, the more sun they get.
And, you know, given the technology that's available now, there's some limit to where you can fly these things, right? When you get into the higher latitudes, you know the sunlight isn't as strong. So they're saying that with the batteries that are available now, they can get to 20 degree latitudes. But as battery technology improves, then that range should increase. They think they can get to about 30 degrees with a conventional design. If you go above 30 degrees latitude, up to 30 or 35, then you have to get a more exotic design going, as they said. But the this aircraft uses lithium polymer batteries, nothing fancy, nothing advanced, just typical batteries. And also thin film gallium arsenide solar cells from Alta Devices. And overall, they say the The efficiency is in the low 20% kind of range. We'll have a photo of this in the show notes. And I think, David, the reason they had to build a wing section in three pieces is because it doesn't fit in the hangar if it's all connected into one. So we have a photo from Aurora Flight Sciences that shows this aircraft sitting outside of the hangar and really gives you a sense for just how huge this wingspan is.
Hopefully it's not made with wax.
That's right. And the first test aircraft is going to be battery powered only. Solar power comes in the second and third test aircraft. And they're going to do flight testing in Puerto Rico. And that's supposed to take place, I guess, starting in April of 2019.
So we'll follow this up next year. Let's hope Aurora Flight Sciences is successful because, you know, this thing looks like it should be flying on Mars, Max. Really, it's like all of those other science fiction aircraft that we've seen over time. So, of course, let's talk about this. You dial in for your pizza. You call your Domino's or Papa John's or your local pizza delivery place. And by law, they're not allowed to deliver by 30 minutes or less. But your delivery screwed up. Well, it was going to happen to our industry too, folks. I'm really sorry to announce this. But from Australia and WeTalkUAV.com, food delivery drones are annoying residents of Australia because, of course, drones are noisy, scare away the local birds' life, and are an invasion of privacy, and people aren't getting their food because the neighbors are upset. Not in my backyard, as they would like to say.
This comes from a program, a project, an initiative from Wing, which, of course, is the Alphabet X initiative that's part of, that's Google's parent company. And they're doing some trials in Australia, and particularly in Canberra, and they've set up a test where they will fly certain fast food to people who live within 10 kilometers of a delivery base. And even though the drone flight hours are restricted between 7 a.m. and 4 p.m., yeah, as David mentions, there are neighbors, residents of the area that are just not enjoying the sights and sounds of drones carrying fast food overhead.
It's not resonating with the residents. I don't know what else to do. But we knew this was going to happen, Max. Inherently, quads and multi-rotors are noisy. I mean, for drone delivery to be successful, we're going to have quieter aircraft. We've talked about battery life and we've talked about capacity. But another thing is, environmentally sound aircraft, you know, jet noise and propeller noise and aircraft noise is always a big deal. And even if you're just having a military base that's surrounded by a civilian population, imagine bringing those aircraft to your neighbor's backyard. It had to happen, but it is kind of a important aspect that we don't really talk about is decibels and noise, you know, noise pollution.
Yeah, and there's some basic physics at work here, right? I mean, if you've got spinning propellers, well, with an electric aircraft, you don't have the problem of engine noise, but you do, of course, have the problem of the prop noise. And the way to make quieter props, at least the easy way, I guess, is larger propellers and maybe fewer of them. But the smaller the props, the more they're going to buzz. Now, I don't know if there's any other way to address that. Wing says they're currently working to make the drones quieter, but I'm very curious to see how they accomplish that. But, I mean, that's a problem sort of across the industry. Drones, especially when they're close by, have a really irritating sound to them. Multi-rotors anyway. And, if it can be solved here, that would have applications everywhere. Somebody who invents a really quiet propeller that spins at a high rate of speed and it isn't too large, that's going to be a big hit.
Oh, yes. Well, but maybe we need to go to some drone racing.
That's always fun.
I can't believe there's a website called Cheddar.com. But this is from Cheddar.com. Next e-sport craze, autonomous drone racing. The Alpha Pilot Challenge has been released by the Drone Racing League, which is autonomous drone racing instead of first-person view.
Yeah, they say that these autonomous racers are going to use AI, artificial intelligence, which I think that term gets used a little bit too much. It's kind of become a marketing term rather than a specific technical term, so I don't know really what they mean by it. But in any event, these autonomous racers are going to use AI starting next year in 2019 and using the same courses that the human pilots use now. And their idea is they want to accelerate the pace of innovation. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me. If you want to advance the state of autonomous drone flights, use racing drones, and you'll develop the technology, I think, more quickly than any other method.
And interesting that we talk about AI, and like you said, it's become sort of a marketing thing. But having to pre-program a drone to fly those obstacle courses is pretty intense programming. Not to mention, what do you do when the drone in front of you cuts you off? So eventually, the drones are going to have to start thinking for themselves. So it's a good way to foster innovation, like you said, Max. And Lockheed Martin is involved with this, so it's kind of surprising. There's a third. Normally, when we have these conversations, the words Airbus or Boeing would show up. But in this case, it's Lockheed Martin. So a lot of good can come out of fun. And like my partner knows, the best automobile innovations have always come from Formula One racing, right?
Yeah, if it's got a motor, race it, and you'll make a better vehicle. But there's a $2 million prize pool in this league, which is pretty impressive. That ought to be providing some incentive. And I think maybe most interesting is the DRL has sort of an end objective of getting to a point where they could race these autonomous drones against the piloted drones that we have been seeing so far. So that's kind of the acid test, I think, David, is which drone crosses the finish line first, the autonomous drone or the piloted drone? That'll be really fascinating.
Our next story comes from InterDrone. The OAS requests information for heavy lift UAS during wildfires. Now, here in the States, we've had severe wildfires in California, with a death toll that we're not used to seeing. Just in time, the OAS, which is the Office of Aviation Services of the Department of Interior, the DOI, has requested some information about UASs to conduct heavy lift cargo delivery during wildfires and emergency situations, just in time. So this is a proposal of getting the drones involved in fighting the fires and as well as delivering supplies, etc.
Yeah, it does seem like they're looking at potentially using drones in two different contexts. One is to carry water and fire retardant, the way we see helicopters and aircraft, airplanes doing that now. The other thing that they want to explore is carrying equipment and supplies into the remote terrain where you have some limitations, no connectivity, and operating beyond visual line of sight. So those two kinds of applications that seem, to me anyway, very, very different. But there's a solicitation out from the Office of Aviation Services. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. They're looking at this kind of broadly, and I think that they're going out and exploring a number of different things. They say that these aircraft will be tasked to operate. This is in the solicitation. Aircraft will be tasked to operate in hot, dry, high altitudes during the fire season. The OAS is also evaluating, they say, the use of contractor-owned, government-operated UAS for the purpose of wildland fire, search and rescue, other resource missions. And they list some criteria for these UAS.
Now, this is not your normal quadcopter. I mean, it's 300 pounds or less. Runway independent, so capable of vertical takeoff and landing or assisted launch. The ability for both day and night operations at high density altitude, and equipped with electro-optical or infrared standardized gimbal, and the ability to interchange payloads with a mapping payload. So they are setting some specific specs necessary to operate in a very hostile environment. But when you talk about things like smoke jumpers, where they're going into fires and they're isolated, being able to get them food and supplies is really important. And not necessarily, I mean, when we think about firefighting wildfires, we think of, in the aviation community, we always see tankers dropping retardant or water on the fires. But there are other aspects that a drone could do besides just dumping water or dumping fire retardant. They could be delivering supplies. They could be doing searching hotspots using infrared. So this is really important. Now, the state of California deadline for response is December 7th at 5 p.m. Eastern time. So anybody out there who's interested, get involved, because you might save some lives in the future.
And as well, the government's requesting a pricing rough order of magnitude estimate. This would be pricing for leasing an aircraft that can perform these missions for a six-month period. They're looking for that to include training for government pilots and as well as at least one spare drone. So, yeah, hopefully, David, we'll see some good responses from the industry. I don't know if they will be existing aircraft or if the proposals, the responses to the solicitation will be for the design of new aircraft. Not sure, but it'll all be fascinating to watch.
So, yeah, we'll look forward to that. Okay, let's this week in FAA news, and it's not really all that positive for the FAA this week. The FAA unmanned aircraft system waiver process, according to the Inspector General, has found room for improvement, particularly regarding timeliness approving waivers. Not a good sign.
This audit was conducted between May 2017 and September 2018. So it was a pretty lengthy period during which OIG observed the data. And they focused on how the FAA approved waivers under the Part 107 rule for small drone operations. And they also looked at how the FAA conducts risk-based oversight of remote pilots with waivers. And as a result, the OIG noted that the FAA's Flight Standards Office had disapproved 73% of operational waiver requests. So that indicates that, you know, garbage in, garbage out, bad data coming in or insufficient data coming in or some deficiency in the applications for waivers, you know, has to be taking place with a rejection rate that high. So they looked at that. And the audit provides 8 recommendations for the FAA.
And in all fairness to the FAA, we've had this discussion that they have these requests for waivers aren't necessarily the best written things in the world. So a lot of times the FAA has struggled having to send things back multiple times and eventually declining them just because they're not well written. But the OIG says the following. Number one, they need to assess the workforce tasked with reviewing the waiver and authorization requests to determine if air traffic organization staffing is adequate and take appropriate action as needed.
The second recommendation to the FAA is that the FAA assess the performance of their non-automated airspace waiver process and determine if setting goals for volume and timeliness would improve the process, and if so, implement these goals. So they're saying the FAA isn't measuring their performance. If they set goals, measure to those goals, then that should have a positive impact on the process.
The next one actually is based on LANC, which is the low altitude authorization and notification capability. Implement the performance metrics that they're getting and use that to evaluate the applications coming through. So one of the other complaints the FAA has had is we don't have data. Well, the data is now flowing through. Now the FAA has to start using it.
And the fourth recommendation is that internal controls should be created that improve the consistency in responses. They're looking at using templates to correspond with applicants regarding requests for information. So if you're getting the same requests from folks for more information about the process, then the use of templates would make sure that, well, the responses were consistent and that the responses contained all of the information that the applicant needed. So that seems like a good idea to me.
Update the National Flight Standards Work Program guidelines to require field offices to perform inspections on a sample commercial drone operators in the area for a 2-year period designed to increase availability inspection data for creating risk profiles of UAS. Again, work towards getting the more data you need to be able to process this stuff quicker. In this case, having hands-on experience from the local flight standards work program.
Now, interestingly, this recommendation number 5 here is the only one of the 8 that the FAA did not concur with. The FAA says the agency did not agree with the need to conduct an additional 2 years worth of sample inspections to accumulate inspection data. However, the OIG says it did agree to implement the new items for UAS oversight during fiscal year 2019 and include these items in its National Work Program Guidelines by August 31st, 2019, which they say meets the intent of the recommendation. So that was number 5. Number 6, develop a baseline risk assessment profile of small commercial drone operators to inform inspectors' surveillance planning decisions, as well as procedures to periodically update this profile.
Number 7, issue guidance to field offices on how to obtain FAA information on waiver and or authorization holding UAS operators designed to help them inform their inspection planning. Get with the field offices and the drone operators so they can work together to streamline their processes. You know, this boils down to communication and data. You know, as much as I understand this report, but it is a lot of, the FAA has thrown up these warning flags ahead of time, so this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. And last,
the final recommendation, number 8, provide clarifying guidance to UAS operators regarding the small UAS rules provision relating to operations over people. So that sounds like a number of people who are looking for waivers or who have been looking for waivers for flight over people have not received the guidance that they need to or that they should. So clarification of that guidance is the final recommendation. Now, we'll have a link in the show notes, because we always have links in the show notes, to the full OIG audit report, and you can browse through that if you like.
Well, we got some feedback this week from Gareth in Australia. Lambulance drones used to check animal health during lambing season. Drones are, a lot of words there. Drones fitted with infrared cameras could soon be flying over paddocks, helping sheep farmers save newborn lambs. And basically, this is precision agriculture, although I guess it would be precision horticulture, wouldn't it? They'll fly the drones over the paddocks and use the drones to assess the health of the lambs, you know, and based on the ewe and lamb heat signatures.
So this really is a lambulance, David. That's pretty interesting. This thing is taking thermal images of the lambs?
Exactly. What we're trying, according to co-creator Andrew Bailey, what we're trying to do here is relate that the heat signatures to the likelihood of success for that animal staying alive. So if their bodies are overheating, like a fever, they can tell it. If their bodies are running cool, maybe they're sick. And you can do that with a drone a lot quicker than if someone's going through with a stethoscope or a thermometer hitting each lamb that's in the paddock.
So I wonder how close to the lambs the drone has to get, and if it's so close that the buzzing sound of the drone is going to cause the lambs to bolt.
What's kind of amazing was the farm that they're working on has over 4,000 lambs on their property, and they have a mortality rate of 320 lambs per year, which is 8%.
That's pretty significant. Yeah, we can save those lambs. We can grow them bigger and eat them, I guess.
Either that or you can make wool.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many wool sweaters they really need in Australia.
Oh, I think quite a number of them.
But we, like you said, you wonder how one of the things about animals interacting with drones is like what we talked about earlier in the earlier Australia story, that the animals didn't like the drones flying around even though it was delivering them food. In this case, the lambs wonder how they are as far as being skittish and stuff around them. The other thing is it's using a cell phone app. So it's a very interesting technology, and we're going to categorize it's, you know, our mission statement, drones for good. This is pretty good, you know, little lambs eat divey, to quote my mother. And saving 8 lambs a year or 8% of your lamb population is probably worth scaring them for a little bit with a drone.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. All right, thanks for that feedback. And we're going to wrap this one up. I want to thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. You can find us at theuavdigest.com. And if you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, well, that's theuavdigest.com/265.
And of course, we'd love your feedback, and we love when you send us stories. So send us your stories. We've got a big Australia population that want to hear from us, but there's a big globe out there. How about Canada and the United States and maybe Europe? If you're listening to us, give us a shout out. Let us know where you're listening to us. Let us know what's going on in the industry in your areas, because we want this to be a global podcast. Yeah, Max and I are centered in the United States, but we'd love hearing from you folks. So send us your stories again to feedback@theuavdigest.com, or send it to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/UAV Digest, or Twitter @UAV Digest. Or even better, we'd love for you to join the conversation and become part of our Slack listener team. You can get an invite by sending, again, an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. Max and I will send you your invite, and you can join the conversations there, and we can work with you. So likewise, if you want to buy some swag, you can get it at our Cafe Press store. And lastly, one of the things that we really need you to do, if you really love the show, is leave feedback on your regular podcaster, being it Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Stitcher.com. Leave some feedback there. That way we keep our high ratings and other people can find us so that we can broaden this community. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.